This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
Hamas still has the capability to fire long-range rockets, and that can hit Israel. At the same time, Israel overnight conducted its second sort of small ground incursion into Gaza.
That's our reporter in Jerusalem, Linda Gradstein, on the latest regarding the Israeli-Hamas conflict. Details coming up. Also, a Sudanese activist is honored for her work on behalf of women and children. And South Africa's Springboks get ready to battle New Zealand's All Blacks in the Rugby World Cup Championship. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story. In the Middle East today, about 10 aid trucks have crossed from Egypt into the Gaza Strip. The Palestinian territory has been under an Israeli blockade since Hamas militants from Gaza attacked communities in Israel on October the 7th. The United Nations warns food, fuel, and medical supplies have nearly run out. Also today, the Gaza Health Ministry, run by the Hamas organization, says more than 7,000 people have died in Gaza since fighting began. Also, Hamas rejected Israeli accusations that it uses hospitals as military command posts. Three weeks into the deadliest war between Israel and Hamas, some political observers say it's already clear that the bloodshed has flipped long-standing assumptions in Israel and the region upside down. Our reporter in Jerusalem, Linda Gradstein, briefs us on the latest and says Israelis' sense of personal security has been shattered, with the country's security service and military intelligence admitting failures that led to the Hamas attack.
There was a barrage of dozens of rockets at central Israel earlier today, including one that hit an apartment building in Tel Aviv. There were four Israelis injured, one was relatively seriously. But it's a sign that Hamas still has the capability to fire long-range rockets, and that can hit Israel. At the same time, Israel overnight conducted its second sort of small ground incursion into Gaza. It sent tanks and troops in looking for Hamas infrastructure, and there were no injuries. And Israel came on the Israeli side. Israel came back out. And Israel continues to bombard Hamas with airstrikes. And the Palestinian Health Ministry says that 7,000 Palestinians have now been killed in the Israeli airstrikes in the past 3 weeks.
So, Linda, on October 7th, Hamas militants, undetected, moved into Israel, killing over 1,400 people, the vast majority civilians, capturing over 200 hostages. And military observers actually describe that scenario as Israel's security apparatus falling asleep at the wheel.
Yeah, you know, it's hard to understand how this happened. Israel has all kinds of technology and had been observing Hamas training. And in fact, the day before had seen this kind of coming. And these observers, as you say, mostly girls, by the way, had warned their superiors that Hamas seems to be doing something. And the decision was, well, it's just another military drill. And in addition, it seems that a lot of the bases were not, it was a Jewish holiday. It was both the Sabbath and a holiday. And so a lot of the soldiers were sent home. And I think it goes to a fundamental miscalculation about Hamas. And they really, the Israeli, both political and military establishment, believed that Hamas wanted a peace deal with Israel, wanted to make things better for Palestinians in Gaza, and was not going to start a war. Now, this operation was apparently planned for almost 2 years. Now, it's hard to understand exactly what happened, and I assume that after the war is over, there will be a commission of inquiry. But several senior Israeli military officials and political officials, including the defense minister, the chief of staff, have taken responsibility. The only person who hasn't, by the way, is Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu.
Israel now has vowed to destroy Hamas, but as we talked about it yesterday, This will not be an easy task against a group with significant public support and an entrenched military presence in Gaza. And even, Linda, if Israel prevails, it has not presented a clear exit strategy.
Right. That's the big question. In other words, eventually Israel will be able to destroy Hamas, at least militarily. The Hamas has a network of tunnels running underneath Gaza, and Israel has, you know, said that it can no longer coexist with Hamas in any kind of a military Hamas. But what happens afterwards? I mean, you know, from 1967 until 2005, when Israel withdrew from Gaza, Israel controlled Gaza, and it was responsible for the health and education and, you know, taking out the garbage in Gaza. Does Israel want to do that again? I mean, Gaza is very crowded, very, very poor. The majority of the population lives on less than $2 per person per day. Unemployment is 46%. And that's sort of one of the sad things, is that basically nobody wants Gaza. The alternative is the Palestinian Authority, which controls the West Bank. But it's not clear to me if they're in a position to take over Gaza, or if they even want to, if they were. The head of the Palestinian Authority, Mahmoud Abbas, is very old, weak, corrupt. So basically, this whole thing is just sort of falling apart before our eyes. And it doesn't seem that Israel has any kind of an exit strategy or a plan for what comes afterwards.
That was reporter Linda Gradstein speaking with me from Jerusalem. For a president who campaigned on ending forever wars, Joe Biden now faces a conflict in Gaza on top of Russia's invasion of Ukraine and rising Sino-US tensions over Taiwan. How he handles these challenges may impact his re-election bid in 2024. White House Bureau Chief Patsy Wiri-Koswara has this report.
Amid mounting Palestinian deaths from Israeli airstrikes that the Hamas-run health ministry in Gaza says have surpassed 7,000, this comment from U.S. President Joe Biden.
I have no notion that the Palestinians are telling the truth about how many people are killed. I'm sure innocents have been killed, and it's the price of waging a war.
The statement angered American Arabs, Muslims, and others already protesting Biden's handling of the war in Gaza. Robert McCaw from the Council on American-Islamic Relations, the largest Muslim advocacy group, via Skype.
This is shocking and dehumanizing. Would the president feel better if 1,000 Palestinian children had died?
Progressives are also angry. 9 members of Congress, mostly from the progressive wing of Biden's Democratic Party, voted against a resolution backing Israel and condemning Hamas because it did not mourn the loss of Palestinian lives or mention the two-state solution. Various polls show more Americans sympathize with Israelis than with the Palestinians, though younger Americans are more divided. Larry Sabato, director of the University of Virginia Center for Politics, via Skype.
With American Jews, a very important group in terms of votes and also contributions to the Democratic Party, there's been almost universal praise for President Biden and the way he's handled this.
Republicans in Congress are increasingly skeptical of Biden's commitment to fund foreign wars, including newly elected House Speaker Mike Johnson, who is against sending more money to Ukraine without conditions, but is sympathetic to Israel.
The first bill that I'm going to bring to this floor in just a little while will be in support of our dear friend Israel, and we're overdue in getting that done.
The share of voters who approve of Biden's handling of the issue has increased by 9 percentage points since the days immediately following Hamas' attack on Israel. How the war in Gaza will impact Biden's re-election bid in 2024 will depend on whether the conflict can be contained. In neighboring Lebanon, cross-border attacks have intensified between Israel and Iran-backed Hezbollah. Again, Larry Sabato.
If we get involved directly in these forever wars, yes, Biden will suffer. As long as he keeps American troops out of the line of fire, I don't think it will be nearly as controversial, and I don't think it will be a major factor in people's votes.
Sabato added another key factor, whether Palestinian deaths can be minimized and humanitarian aid delivered. Patsy Wiri-Koswara, VOA News at the White House.
Saudi Arabia's foreign ministry says Representatives of Sudan's warring parties have resumed ceasefire negotiations aimed at ending 6 months of conflict that has left more than 9,000 people dead. Saudi officials have expressed hope that the talks between the Sudanese armed forces and the paramilitary rapid support forces will lead to a political agreement with security, stability, and prosperity for Sudan's people. Cameron Hudson, a senior associate with the Africa Program at Center for Strategic and International Studies, explained to VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi what prompted the two rivals to resume truce talks in Jeddah.
Well, I think they've been under growing pressure to resume these talks. Obviously, there's no justification for the continuation of fighting. And so I think in order to avoid potential additional pressure or sanctions, I think both sides are trying to look reasonable, like they are interested in talking, when at the same time, I think that the talks are going to provide them with the cover that they both need to continue the fighting on the ground.
Saudi's foreign ministry said all negotiators should abide by an earlier agreement announced on May 11th to protect civilians, as well as a short-term ceasefire agreement signed on May 20th. What could make or break this round of negotiations?
Well, I think we have to see something different added to these negotiations. You know, in May, when the previous round of negotiations happened, it was very clear that the parties were willing to say anything to get out of the negotiation. So they would agree to documents and to ceasefires that they had no intention of living up to or respecting. And at the same time, neither the Saudis nor the Americans really presented any consequences to the parties for reneging on their commitments. And so I think if something is going to be different this time, there have to be consequences for signing documents and making promises and not holding true to them. So I think that has to be different. As far as what's going on the ground, there doesn't seem to be any real difference in terms of control of territory. Both sides are continuing to go back and forth. And so as long as neither side has the upper hand, I don't think that either side will come to these talks more or less prepared to negotiate than they were before.
Previous mediation attempts yielded brief truces, but were systematically violated. What would make this negotiation produce a political solution?
Well, again, I think that we can't be looking to this to produce a political solution. The Saudis and the Americans are not on the same page, clearly. If the Saudis are talking about this producing a political solution when there are political talks going on in Addis Ababa right now among civil society leaders about what a civilian government might look like going forward, then I think we have to get straight what these talks in Jeddah are about. Washington has said that these talks are about securing a ceasefire so that we can have talks about a political process. Presumably, that political process will happen somewhere else. Right now, it's happening in Addis Ababa. And clearly, there's a humanitarian track, which is being discussed in Cairo. And so I think that if the Saudis believe that they're going to solve all Sudan's problems in Jeddah, and no one else believes that, then I think we're off to a bad start.
Would the war in Gaza pressure the two sides to some sort of an agreement because the world attention is focused elsewhere?
Well, I think that they are counting on world attention being focused elsewhere, and they see this as an opportunity. At the same time, I think pressure has a role to play. We have not seen the Saudis use any pressure, really, and they have enormous economic pressure that they can bring to bear. Washington has only used very modest sanctions pressure on either of the two parties. So I think they have been motivated up to this point of trying to use more of a moral argument than a punitive one. At some point, I think there is reason to believe that we should approach this from a punitive perspective. But again, as both sides get more and more deeply entrenched in this conflict, even punitive steps, I think, are going to do little to dissuade them from continuing the fighting.
That was Cameron Hudson, a senior associate with the African Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, speaking with VOA's Mohamed El-Shenawi. You're listening to Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Sudanese women's activist Enas Muzamel was honored this week with the Vital Voices 22nd Annual Global Leadership Award. Muzamel is a pro-democracy activist and human rights defender, coordinating crisis response efforts to support women and girls in Sudan. In April, after rival military factions instigated a violent conflict, Muzamel was forced to flee her home in Khartoum, but even while displaced, she leads critical relief efforts and connects survivors of sexual violence to health care and basic services. VOA's Carol Van Dam interviewed Muzamel via Skype.
I work in a national small organization called Medania, which means civilian-led, you know, state. And we work in the area I do, like my favorite work, which is empowerment of women and young women through projects and programs, like building their capacities in some fields, like providing safe spaces for them to discuss difficult issues like gender and religion, gender and ethnicity, these kind of things, legal reforms, the social pressure. I also work in the advocacy for the inclusion of women in peace processes and also the advocacy for the peace in the country. I work also in the area of promoting like human rights in the country.
After you and other groups like yourself were successful in making Omar al-Bashir step down and a new government, for at least a transitional government, at least for a while, was there, weren't some of the laws, some of the antiquated laws that were discriminatory against women eliminated?
Mainly the public order law, but the problem is the public order law, it still exists within the Sudan criminal law. So 90% comes from there, because all these things in the difficult parts of the law are coming straight from the religion. And that's something you cannot change, because it has to do with the identity of the state, and the separation between the state and the religion is almost impossible, never happened.
What do you tell women who are facing that kind of patriarch society? How do you help when you say you build capacity? How do you encourage women to be strong and to express themselves?
We start usually with helping them to move within the space that they have, even if it's very small. Like, we start with education. They have to know their rights. Sometimes they don't know their rights. They don't know that they have certain rights still they can enjoy. They have to resist and not to accept things as they are. And also, there is, like, after the revolution in Sudan, a big, like, awareness campaign that happened, especially with this contribution of women, remarkable contribution to the overthrow of Omar al-Bashir. And too many women, yeah, you saw them in the videos going on the streets. Some of them are very conservative. Some of them are even using niqab covering them. But they still, they want democracy, because they know what democracy can bring to them. At the same time, we keep advocating for their rights by putting pressure on policymakers. I'm always asking, like, the international community, always it's our helpers, by putting pressure on the government to sign and ratify international agreements, because we are isolated, and Sudan is not signing most of them.
It seemed like Sudan was so close to having a real transitional government that was moving toward a democratic form of government, and then it all got, you know, stamped out with this conflict between the two warring generals. Do you still have hope? Do women still have hope from Sudan that things will turn out right?
Yes, I still have hope. 75% of the population and their young people are really motivated. And yes, they're ready for the change. They are full of hope. They cannot win it now, this battle against guns and this torturing and arresting and so. But at some point, I think another revolution will come to Sudan.
That was Sudanese activist Enas Muzamel. She was speaking with my colleague Carol Van Dam. Kenyan developers have designed a mobile phone application that police say is helping to safeguard smartphones from theft, recover stolen cell phones, and prevent lost data. Victoria Amunga reports from Nairobi.
Smartphones hold sensitive information and have become an essential part of modern life. The theft of a mobile phone can disrupt its owner's life in many ways. In Kenya, mobile phone thefts are surging. Police say stolen mobile phones account for 21% of crimes committed nationwide.
Take this phone now, should alarm.
It's a challenge Kenyan developers are taking on with the creation of a mobile application they say can help protect smartphones from thieves. The app called Secure has been designed with security options that depend on how the smartphone is being used and where it's placed, for example, in a pocket or on a surface. Ibrahim Bari is the chief operating officer of the California-based company Secure Technology Solutions.
Let's say you are in an office whereby you don't necessarily trust everyone around you. You activate it and put the phone down. If someone touched the phone, it will trigger an alarm. And once an alarm is triggered, it also takes pictures of the person who had the phone. And nothing can off that alarm unless you put a PIN number that you've chosen yourself as the owner of the phone.
At least 300 users have downloaded the app since its launch early October, say Secure officials. Clarice Kibi recalls when her mobile was stolen.
It was a pickpocket. And at the time, I didn't even know it was gone. Because, frankly, it was even strapped on my chest, and I didn't know. I took something that I knew wouldn't be easily pickpocketed from. So I was shocked when I realized I don't have the phone.
Cybersecurity expert Evans Mungai says stolen or compromised smartphones can hold a large amount of data. Mungai told VOA that technologies like the new app are helping, but also have limits.
We need to look for ways of involving larger society, and even OEMs, original equipment manufacturers, to be able to execute effectively in tracking these devices from a serial number level, because at this time they are not able to execute that. And they are limited to maybe, say, connectivity.
Meanwhile, Kenya's communication authorities say they are urging the public to take extra steps to safeguard their mobile phones. Victoria Amunga, VOA News, Nairobi.
Rugby fans across the world will be glued to their screens tomorrow to watch the 2023 World Cup Finals, a repeat of 1995's tournament when South Africa's Springboks faced New Zealand's All Blacks. VOA's Mike Hovey has more.
The Springboks and the All Blacks have announced their squads for Saturday's clash. Valen Kirtley, the sports editor for Newsroom Africa, says rugby fanatics are expecting to watch world-class rugby.
For any neutral when it comes to rugby, this is the final that they all wanted. Certainly for South African and for New Zealand fans, this is a storied rivalry between these two nations.
Springboks captain Siya Kolisi echoed that sentiment.
It's huge. It's always big play against the All Blacks, but to play it in a World Cup final when it's number one and two team in the world playing head-to-head, I don't think it's stuff that you can dream about, because it doesn't happen often. I don't think it will happen in our lifetime again to have two teams like this.
Kolisi said the Springboks will make African rugby fans proud.
We see it each and every single day, and people tell us how they feel, and people send videos and tell us this is sometimes the only time they are happy about something is when we play. And also, for us, it's for someone that is in my position right now, where I was when I was a kid, for them to know, yes, that it's a season that they're going through. It's a tough time, but it is possible for them to get out of it.
Sam Kane, Kolisi's New Zealand counterpart, said the All Blacks are ready for victory.
You know, we've played two finals, two knockouts, effectively more actually, in a row. So I trust that we're in a good spot there.
The clash between the rivals will be historic, because the winner will be the first to have lifted the Webb Ellis Cup four times in the history of the tournament. Should South Africa win, it'll be back-to-back victories for the Springboks, who won the World Cup in Japan in 2019. In 1995, when the two teams faced off in the finals, the Springboks defeated the All Blacks 15-12. Mike Ove, VOA News, Washington.
And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbil Iyabaro, and our engineer, John Dryden, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.